sir.
The whole end of the stand at one side is actually in flames. The game is actually stopped here at Ballybrain.
Shovels and picks and hands going through rocks and debris.
It was a constructive meeting. So constructive, in fact, that I look forward to welcoming Mr. Gorbachev to the United States next year.
This is 1985, the year in review. The major stories and news events of the past year as reported by the UPI Radio Network.
This is Dennis Daly in the UPI Radio News Center in Washington. Our look back at the top stories of 1985 continues in 60 seconds on the UPI Radio Network.
Inviting you to join me here on many of these UPI stations for football analysis. You'll hear from the players.
A lot sort of puts us in front of the firing squad with the head guy saying aim.
The coaches.
Not a miracle worker. I'm not a genius. Don't lay any belief in the fact that we are going to be successful because I'm here.
The fans.
Oh, the Dallas Cowboys going to win the Super Bowl.
Miami.
I think the Redskins going to win.
I think it's those black jerseys, that dark color scares the other guy.
Because they have good.
And the great moment.
California has won it. This is the most incredible finish I have ever seen in a football game.
Football analysis. It's fun. It's exciting. And it lets you know what's going on. College football and the pros. Join us right here, won't you?
...1985 had begun with a presidential inauguration, forced inside because of bitterly cold weather in Washington, D.C. It was President Reagan's second swearing-in, and only the first time since the Nixon administration that a president had served two terms. It would become a very busy year for the Reagan administration, as UPI Radio's White House correspondent Bill Small tells us.
Dennis, 1985 took Ronald Reagan to the heights and to the depths. He was sworn in for a second term, and he talked peace in Geneva with the leader of the Soviet Union. But he also had to undergo major cancer surgery, and he found his number one domestic policy initiative blocked in Congress by members of his own political party. In late November, Mr. Reagan and Soviet leader Gorbachev traveled to Geneva, following in the footsteps of numberless national leaders who over the centuries had met there to look for a way to live in peace. When Mr. Reagan returned, he spoke to a joint session of Congress.
I can't claim that we had a meeting of the minds on such fundamentals as ideology or national purpose, but we understand each other better, and that's a key to peace.
There were few concrete results from the summit, but both sides agreed to keep talking, and the two leaders agreed to summit meetings in each of the next 2 years. In July, doctors found a large polyp in Mr. Reagan's colon and removed it along with 2 feet of the colon. The biopsy results came from Dr. Steven Rosenberg.
The president has cancer.
Later, Mr. Reagan had to have 2 patches of skin cancer removed from his nose. Perhaps Mr. Reagan's biggest disappointments this past year came from Capitol Hill. Despite his objections, Congress began putting together a series of economic sanctions to show U.S. disgust for the South African system of apartheid. The president eventually announced some sanctions of his own. Congress also defied the president in issues involving international trade. Protectionist sentiments in Congress pushed Mr. Reagan to announce a series of measures to stem that tide.
It is wrong for the American worker and American businessman to continue to bear the burden imposed by those who abuse the world trading system.
But Congress defied threats of vetoes and sent Mr. Reagan a bill to cut imports of shoes, textiles, and copper. His spokesman promised a veto. Mr. Reagan's biggest congressional letdown came on a plan to reform the nation's tax reform system, the capstone of his domestic policy agenda. The administration worked with the chairman of the democratically controlled House Ways and Means Committee to produce a tax reform bill, and Mr. Reagan called for action.
As for America's fair share tax plan, we're shooting for Christmas time. Economic growth and tax fairness are gifts we owe ourselves and our children.
But it was not to be. House Republicans, irritated because they felt left out of the tax reform process, defied the president and voted not to let the tax reform bill come to the floor of the House. Spokesman Larry Speaks tried to put a good face on it all.
Sometimes they differ with us, sometimes we differ from them, sometimes we both differ with each other. And that's going to happen from time to time.
But in private, Mr. Reagan was described as steaming, and one official was quoted as saying Mr. Reagan would neither forgive nor forget what the House Republicans had done. In the last few days of the congressional session, the White House and Republican leaders frantically sought a compromise to keep tax reform alive, with few prospects of success. Mr. Reagan was successful in urging support of a controversial plan to put mandatory limits on the federal deficit over the next 5 years. He stumped hard for the Graham-Rudman-Hollings bill, but he signed it into law in private, handing out a written statement warning of substantial program cuts this coming year and noting several questions about the constitutionality of the bill. Almost as Mr. Reagan raised those questions, Democratic Congressman Mike Sinar of Oklahoma was filing suit in federal court, charging that the bill is unconstitutional. This is Bill Small at the White House.
September 19th and 20th were the days the earth shook in and around Mexico City, and the days that 8,000 died. Jim Grivner ran to the U.S. Embassy to tell his story.
The floor was shaking, so we ran like three stories down onto the street, and the street was shaking. This hotel about a block away collapsed. It was about 10 stories high, and they caught on fire.
UPI Radio's Bob Fuss went immediately to Mexico City and began describing the rescue efforts.
This process is terribly slow. While some bulldozers are being used, mostly it is hand work, shovels and picks and hands going through rocks and debris.
The next night, Fuss was having supper when an aftershock, a major quake in its own right, hit.
It gained strength slowly and steadily, first swaying back and forth, but it was interspersed with very sharp sideways jolts. Most patrons ran out into the street, though clearly it was not as strong as the devastating quake on Thursday. It did last well over 2 minutes, caused substantial damage in the city, and sent several local residents into tears in the neighborhood that I was in, fearing that more buildings would come down.
There were miraculous stories of rescues in Mexico, some coming more than a week after people were buried. Hundreds lost their lives in mudslides in Puerto Rico when rain spewed out of Hurricane Juan. And in mid-November, a long dormant volcano in Colombia erupted. The heat from the lava melted snow on the mountain. A rushing torrent of mud and water completely covered several Colombian towns. More than 25,000 died. The sound of angry parents protesting a decision by the Queens, New York school system to allow an unnamed second grader with AIDS to attend regular classes. The parents staged a boycott for a while, keeping their own kids away from class.
They're jeopardizing the welfare of all the children for just a few.
The city is taking away our rights to decide what's best for our children. And that's basically what the issue is.
AIDS had quickly become the preeminent health issue of 1985. Its presence among us was hammered home when a Paris hospital made this announcement.
Mr. Rock Hudson has acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
The world watched Rock Hudson die a quickly degenerative death. Support for AIDS research gathered steam with the revelation of Hudson's ailment. Actress Elizabeth Taylor, who helped organize an AIDS fundraiser.
I think it really hit home, not just to the entertainment industry, but to all of America, because rock is a household word.
During this past year, the military announced AIDS testing, first for all recruits, then for all personnel. Not since the bond drives and USO shows of the Second World War had American musicians worked so hard together for causes and fundraising drives as they did in 1985. There were two major concerts. UPI Radio's Jenny Casola was at both of them.
July 13, 1985. Tens of thousands of people gathered in Philadelphia and London for Live Aid. Many of the world's most popular music stars performed in the two mega concerts to raise money for African famine victims. In September, country music star Willie Nelson organized another mega concert to benefit America's farmers. It was called Farm Aid, and Nelson said its purpose was to heighten the public's awareness of the nation's farm crisis. This is Jenny Casola.
May was the month that a rising tide of hooliganism among British soccer fans would erupt into a tide of death and destruction. In early May, someone apparently tossed a firework or smoke bomb into the soccer stands at Bradford, England. The prank led to 53 deaths. In just minutes, the entire stands were afire. A radio reporter covering the match was swept up in the panic.
Let's get all those people out of there. Let's get those people. Just take your time. Don't rush. Go down there. Take your time going down there. Don't pull on the wires. Keep the electrics over there. Keep them. Take their time. Don't rush. Don't push. We are going to have to disconnect very shortly because it really is saving all the time. We're taking a break. We're getting out of here. to?
Later that month, at an international game in Brussels, Belgium, British fans kill more than 30 people, mostly Italians. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's reaction was immediate.
It used to be our pride that we really were a nation of sportsmanlike people. That is in danger.
For a time, British soccer teams were prohibited from participating in international games, and there were strict controls put on the use of alcoholic beverages at sporting events in Great Britain.
1985, the year in review. A look back at the major stories of the past year continues on the UPI Radio Network.
If you've been listening to UPI Roundtable, you've heard Nancy Reagan talk about life with her husband.
He doesn't bring it home with him. You know that he's upset, but he doesn't. He's one of a kind.
You've heard a former anorexic talk about living with an eating disorder.
I remember being in the hospital and ripping an IV out of my arm because it had too many calories. I couldn't eat a full piece of toast at a time because that just seemed like a full meal. It would take me about 2 hours if I was going to eat an apple.
You've heard Postal Union Chief Mo Biller respond to the government's latest contract offer.
Garbage in capital letters. G-A-R-B-A-G-E.
Hi, I'm Vicki Barker. If you've been listening to UPI Roundtable, you know that each week we bring you the people you want to hear and the information you need to know, be it medicine, politics, or showbiz. It's all here on UPI Roundtable. If you don't know that, well, maybe you should start listening.
1985 will be remembered as the deadliest year in the history of commercial aviation. Just as the year was ending, tragedy struck again. 248 American service personnel returning from a peacekeeping stint in the Middle East were killed when their charter jet crashed on takeoff from Gander, Newfoundland. President Reagan went to Fort Campbell, Kentucky to comfort the surviving families and friends.
We wonder at the stark tragedy of it all. For lost were not only the 248, but all of the talent, the wisdom, and the idealism that they had accumulated. Lost, too, were their experience and their enormous idealism. Who else but an idealist would choose to become a member of the armed forces and put himself or herself in harm's way for the rest of us?
Two jumbo jets were lost in 85, one belonging to Air India. UPI's John Ryan reported after the jet fell into the sea off the Irish coast.
The aircraft was on its way from Montreal to London's Heathrow Airport. The cause of the crash isn't known yet, and there was no warning from the pilot that the jumbo was in trouble.
That same day, baggage from another jet, also en route out of Canada, exploded at the Narita Airport outside Tokyo. Two baggage handlers died in that incident. The worst accident of the year was the worst ever. A Japan Airlines jet went out of control on a domestic flight. The plane's pilot struggled with the controls of the 747 for many minutes before it finally hit a mountainside. 520 died. Here in the U.S., there was a string of airline crashes, a major crash at Milwaukee, several commuter crashes, and a Delta L-1011 fell short of the runway on August 2nd in bad weather while on approach to the Dallas-Fort Worth airport.
The only thing left that I could see from the freeway was the tail of the plane in a section of about five or six windows ahead of the tail, totally charred.
31 in the tail section survived. 133 others did not. By year's end, nearly 2,000 people were to have died in air crashes worldwide. Air safety and the safety of travelers was further complicated this past year by a rise in terrorism and hijackings. We have two reports. The first from UPI Radio's Carol Brooks in London.
America held hostage. It all sounded familiar, but this time it was Beirut, not Iran, and this time it was an airliner, not an embassy. On June 14th, TWA Flight 847 took off from Athens, bound for Rome, when two passengers armed with guns and hand grenades ordered the pilot to fly to Beirut. The nightmare didn't end until 17 days later. The plane zigzagged back and forth between Beirut and Algiers, and several of the 153 people on board were let go in different groups. The hijackers were demanding that over 700 Shiite Muslim prisoners be released from Israeli jails. U.S. Navy diver Robert Steedham was the victim of their threat to execute the hostages. He was beaten, shot in the head, and his body was thrown onto the tarmac at Beirut Airport. President Reagan vowed not to give in to the hijackers.
To do so would only invite more terrorism. Nor will we ask nor pressure any other government to do so.
The situation also sparked one of the biggest media wars ever. The hijackers were calling all of the information shots, and they chose an ABC crew to interview Captain John Testrake, the pilot of the plane. Testrake called on the Reagan administration not to try and rescue the hostages by force. He spoke with a gun held to his head.
I think that we'd all be dead men if they did, because we're continually surrounded by many guards.
In the days that followed, there was a lot more confusion, but finally, on June 30th, the remaining 39 hostages were set free. But the Reagan administration is still faced with the problem of how to obtain the safe release of six other Americans who are still being held hostage in Lebanon. This is Carol Brooks.
As the year went on, terrorists again struck tourists in the Middle East. This time, a cruise liner was involved, and another American died. We have that story from Giselle McAuliffe, also at our London Bureau.
The Italian luxury liner Achille Lauro was hijacked by Palestinians in mid-October. At first, Yasser Arafat denied the captors were members of the PLO.
We are trying to find the link from where and to whom they are belong.
Despite Arafat's claim, when the ship anchored off Egypt's Port Said, PLO member Mohammed Abbas helped negotiate an end to the hijacking and was later accused of masterminding the attack. Relief for the apparent peaceful conclusion to the takeover was quickly replaced by outrage over the cold-blooded murder of the elderly American passenger, Leon Klinghoffer. And when Washington discovered Egypt was flying Abbas and the hijackers to freedom in Tunis, President Reagan ordered the plane intercepted and forced to land in Italy.
These young Americans sent a message to terrorists everywhere. A message, you can run, but you can't hide.
On November 24th, air travelers were the victims once again, with the hijacking of an Egyptian passenger jet en route from Athens to Cairo. The plane landed in Malta, and when the hijackers began shooting passengers with each passing hour, Egyptian commandos were brought in to storm the plane. It was a tragic end to a terrible ordeal, with 60 passengers dying in the crossfire between the soldiers and the hijackers. Australian passenger Anthony Lyons described what happened.
A lot of people were being shot on the tarmac because the Egyptian commandos didn't know who was a terrorist and who wasn't.
Since the shootout, there has been an international debate about the use of force to end a hijacking. But the only conclusion all seem agreed upon is the need to tighten security at the world's airports. This is Giselle McAuliffe.
For a while, it seemed like everyone was spying on the United States, including several otherwise trusted members of the military. UPI Radio's Barbara Campbell explains.
The public first heard of John Walker in May, but by then he had already been passing U.S. military secrets to the Soviet Union for two decades. Accused of spying with him and facing prison terms are Walker's son Michael, brother Arthur, and friend Jerry Whitworth. John and Michael pleaded guilty and agreed to reveal all they had told the Soviets in exchange for a shorter sentence for the son. Prosecutor Michael Schatzow says the government needed that information, but refused to lighten John Walker's sentence.
Because of his long history of espionage activities and the harm that he's done to the country from those, we were not willing to trade away anything in terms of his own sentencing. The only thing that left us was Michael.
John Walker could conceivably be released from prison in 10 years. Michael Walker has no chance for parole for 25 years. After the Walker arrests, authorities picked up one suspect after another in unrelated cases, accusing them of spying for countries including the Soviet Union, Israel, China, and Ghana. This is Barbara Campbell.
There were protest marches, demonstrations, and arrests on college campuses and in Washington, D.C. this past year, as thousands of men and women joined to fight racial injustice. But unlike the protests of the 60s, this time the target was South Africa and the racially repressive system of apartheid. Reverend Jesse Jackson led one of those protests.
We must use our total moral, political, and economic resources to oppose the system of apartheid in South Africa.
One of the most vocal critics of apartheid within South Africa was Bishop Desmond Tutu, a black Anglican bishop who had the year before been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. When the South African government established a state of emergency in more than 30 townships this past July, Bishop Tutu spoke out.
It is quite unjust that there should be a state of emergency, because we will never get true justice peace and stability from the barrel of a gun.
Despite Bishop Tutu's warnings about violence in South Africa, by year's end, nearly 850 people, mostly black, would be killed in racial unrest in that country. American adventurers reached out into the depths of the sea during 1985 and came up with treasure. Part of that treasure, pictures of the sunken liner Titanic, finally located after 73 years, and the first of hundreds of millions of dollars in treasure from a Spanish galleon off the coast of Key West that went down in a hurricane in 1622. 1985 was also the year the two American traditions died. One announcement came from Montgomery Ward.
We're going to begin phasing out the catalog business right away, but we expect that it will take anywhere from 8 to 14 months before we're completely out of it, targeting, say, the end of 1986.
In April, Coca-Cola was put to an early grave, as the Coke company decided the 99-year-old formula might not be the real thing. Consumer outrage prompted its return in July as Classic Coke, though not everybody seemed to care.
I can't drink it. It makes me nauseous. I drink Pepsi.
I don't like Coke. I don't like Pepsi. I don't like anything.
We lost some very familiar faces and voices during the past 12 months. Actress and writer Selma Diamond, the gravelly-voiced bailiff on Night Court, died of cancer. Painter Marc Chagall, Mormon President Spencer Kimball, and former Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart. Actress Ruth Gordon died. In the movie Harold and Maude, she portrayed the familiar theme of a feisty, slightly eccentric senior citizen with a zest for life.
You know, at one time I used to break into pet shops to liberate the canaries. But I decided that was an idea way before its time. Zoos are full, prisons are overflowing. Oh my, how the world still dearly loves a cage.
Actor Yul Brynner died of lung cancer in 1985, leaving a legacy of pleas for others to stop smoking. Bill Scott died. He was one of the country's best-loved cartoon voices.
Hi there! This here is Boo Winkle Moose!
We also lost Orson Welles, actor, writer, director, genius. Best remembered for the movie Citizen Kane and the all-too-scary radio program War of the Worlds and those Paul Masson TV commercials. With the death of Orson Welles, one of the great voices of the 20th century was silenced forever.
With his hand, God lifted the dry land from the deep, spinning it as a potter into a world.
The Year in Review. A look back at the major stories of the past year continues on the UPI Radio Network.
Hi, this is Andy Poland, inviting you to join me here on many of these UPI stations for football analysis. You'll hear from the players.
A lot sort of puts us in front of the firing squad with the head guy saying aim.
The coaches.
Not a miracle worker. I'm not a genius. Don't lay any belief in the fact that we are going to be successful because I'm here.
The fans.
Are the Dallas Cowboys going to win the Super Bowl?
Miami.
I think the Redskins are going to win.
I think it's those black jerseys, that dark color scares the other guys.
Because they are good.
And the great moment.
California has won it. This is the most incredible finish I have ever seen in a football game.
Football analysis. It's fun. It's exciting. And it lets you know what's going on. College football and the pros. Join us right here, won't you?
If we had devoted the past 25 minutes to your 1985 year in review, what would your top stories have been? A change of jobs? A new house? A high school graduation? Or maybe a long illness? Or a death in the family? Needless to say, what happens in our private lives will probably be remembered long after some other major events have been forgotten. This is Dennis Daly.
1985, the year in review. A look back at the major stories of the past year was produced and narrated by Dennis Daly. This is Don Rollins speaking. This is the UPI Radio Network.